This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, Monday, February 23rd. We're having a public hearing on HB 5026, Department of Human Services. We are continuing with this budget. Today is a continuing conversation about vocational rehabilitation.
Ms. Byerly.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, as you just said, today today's presentation is from the Department of Human Services from the Vocational Rehabilitation Program.
Thank you.
Good morning.
And thank you for coming back. You had to, I know, but we appreciate your patience with us.
Madam Chair, don't you just wish every day was a Monday?
Certainly.
But how do you
whatever you say.
I'm sure they do.
Good morning, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, yes, and the rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Trina Lee, and I am the Interim Director for Vocational Rehabilitation. And this morning, joining me is also our Director from the Department of Human Services, Aaron Kelly Seal, and our Chief Information Officer, excuse me, or I guess your Chief Financial Officer today. Sorry, Eric Moore. I want to say thank you, first of all. It's an honor and a privilege to be here to present information about vocational rehabilitation, and specifically I'm going to get into who we are and what we do, bring to light to the committee a few of the challenges that we have facing us, share program outcomes and prioritization, and request investments, long-term financial sustainability, and emphasize our partnership alignment all along the way. But I'm actually getting ahead of myself just slightly. The history of vocational rehabilitation started after the World Wars, when the soldiers returned and our country promised that we would not forget them. The focus was on men returning to the workforce after sustaining injuries in the war. However, it didn't take long to figure out that physical injuries, physical disabilities, was not the only type of disability to prevent individuals coming to the workforce. Now, decades later, we also serve men, women, and youth transitioning into the workforce. Oh, here we go. Let me introduce you a little bit into vocational rehabilitation. Our mission is to assist Oregonians with disabilities to achieve and maintain employment and independence. Our mission describes what we do, but it really doesn't describe how we do it. You're going to see this slide, actually a representation of the slide throughout the presentation. This is the what I'm calling the triangle of our services with multiple layers. And you'll notice that the base layer, the independent living layer, is not technically vocational rehabilitation staff, and I'm going to get into that in just a little bit. But as you work up the pyramid, you'll see that the intensity of the services increase, but the numbers of individuals that we serve actually decrease. I'd like to introduce you to a few Oregonians that with your investment in the past has been able to provide services. This gentleman, his name is Nick. He's from the Prineville area. He's a teen in the youth transition program, and he was able to secure employment in the Ochoco Manufacturing Company, and they manufacture water trucks. The interesting thing about this company is that they needed to have, they wanted to have a student come in and they wanted to have a student come in. However, they needed to make sure that somebody could really pay attention to safety because of the manufacturing. So Nick was in the youth transition program in the Prineville area, and he had such a high work ethic that his counselors really felt that he would be an excellent fit. So he was able to land an interview, but he was extremely nervous, about like I am today, and probably more so, and had to have his counselor attend with him, so a little bit more services. And he also required clothing and eventually a welding helmet. However, his story is really unique because he didn't start out being a welder. He started out sweeping floors. And his supervisor would watch his progress every single week, present reports back to his counselor, and they really grew to have a really good relationship, and he could see that this young man had a very high work ethic. So, and he had an interest in welding. So the last 10 to 15 minutes of every shift, his supervisor allowed him to practice. And then Nick took it upon himself to practice on his own time. And it wasn't long until his skills in welding really grew. In April of last year, he received his first raise. He graduated from high school in June and now is a full-time employee of the Ochoco Water Truck Company.
I'm going to stop you there. This is a wonderful story. Tell us how Nick got to be in the Youth in Transition program.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson. So Nick is a gentleman who suffers from a learning disability and was working in the schools with his youth transition program counselor and a vocational rehabilitation counselor as well. So he was identified as a youth that wanted to go to work but suffered from a learning disability and required some additional assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm actually going to highlight another teen in the youth transition program. This is Icelia, and she is from the Hood River area. And Icelia had a big passion to become a dental assistant, but she also had a learning disability, and with her pre-college test scores, they knew that she was going to struggle in a regular associate's degree. Plus, she needed to obtain an employment authorization card, which she did, and a driver's license as well. So she met at great length with her counselor, with her youth transition program counselor, and she had laid out in her plan all the different steps, and she really wanted to make sure that her passion was truly what she wanted to do. So they were able to land an internship in the Hood River Dental Office, but she needed some work experience as well. So she was able to land a position as a part-time in a retail store as a maintenance person, which you think, well, that's not exactly what she was hoping to do. However, the funds that she was able to generate with the part-time job assisted her when she and her counselor finally found the perfect program for her. She found a program in the Corvallis area. It was a 15-week program. She had to travel back and forth, and vocational rehabilitation was able to assist her in doing that. And the interesting thing about Icelia's story is that she was also required during the program to have a 20-hour observation time, a clinical observation, which she was able to go back to the dental clinic that she had the internship in, and they eventually hired her, first on a part-time basis. She completed that dental program in August of 2014, and now she is a permanent employee at the Hood River Dental Office and working full-time. But her story doesn't end there. She now is studying for her Oregon Radiological Proficiency Certificate so she can x-ray dental patients. So a very excellent story.
That's great. And we have a question for you, Sam.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have absolutely no idea, but how much do people get paid to be a dental assistant? Do you have any idea what the pay scale is?
Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator Steiner-Hewitt, unfortunately, I do not at this time, but I can certainly bring some information.
I'd be grateful because, welding, we know, is a pretty well-paid trade, which is great because we really need lots of welders. But we also need a lot of dental assistants, and I'd be very curious to know, as we place people in, are they actually living wage jobs that they're going into?
They are living wage jobs.
Okay, great.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. we actually started a dental school for hygienists and what have you at Chemeketa Community College here in Salem because of, one, the need, and two, because it is a skill that pays.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you could get the numbers, that'd be great.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Senator.
We'll
appreciate
an extra chair for you down there.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm grateful. This is what we're here for. I'm grateful. I'm sure the chair is as well.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and the committee. I have one more example to share. This is Myron, and Myron came to vocational rehabilitation in 2009 with a ticket to work that was issued by the Social Security Administration. Myron came to our services because he had stamina issues and medical issues due to a head injury. He had had a pretty extensive welding and plumbing background, but he was unable, because of his traumatic brain injury, he was unable to sustain a job for a long period of time. He needed to have an employment opportunity where he could really regulate the amount of work and he could regulate his time on the job. So he chose to become a contractor and open his own business. Because of his head injury, he went to the contractor preparation classes a couple of different times in order to get through them, but he did successfully pass the contractor's testing. He met with a couple of individuals, including his vocational rehabilitation counselor, but also a case manager from eDevelopment, which is a nonprofit organization in the Lane County area, and they helped him build his business, do research, market analysis, write a business plan, and he also attended small business classes and on entrepreneurial development. So here's another example of another Oregonian due to your past investment.
I'm going to stop you for another moment and ask a question. For Myron, Isella, Nick, these are people who we helped, and the type of help that they received is really of a permanent nature.
Correct.
Given their needs and their personal situation, if they had not had access to the types of programs that they benefited from, can you describe what kind of life they might have had and how it relates to state services? Would they have been on public assistance, for example? Would they have been living independently but with supports? What would have happened if they had not received this help?
Coach Nathanson, in the committee, Myron's example, he was on Social Security disability, and so obviously that is a completely different program that vocational rehabilitation doesn't necessarily administer. That's an eligibility requirement. As for the two teens that I highlighted, I don't have the specifics of those cases.
Coach Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm going to speculate just for a minute in answer to your question, just because I think the point you're making is really important. We know that the rate of graduation for youth with disabilities from high school is low. They have a huge achievement gap, and what this program, this youth transition program, does is target youth with disabilities who might not otherwise graduate, and even if they do graduate, might not otherwise obtain employment or pursue post-secondary education. And so when you look at the rate of unemployment among people with disabilities, it's in the 70%, and there are some statistics coming later that'll be more specific about that. And so I think it's fair to say that those young people's, the odds of those young people being unemployed long term and relying on public assistance is very high, but for the intervention of this program, which was able to just help them find a path. And once we help them find that path, this program does not stay with them. It's not like unless the individual has an intellectual or developmental disability, or often sometimes a mental health disability, also will qualify them for that top of the triangle, the supported employment service. What most often occurs once someone becomes employed is that they're employed on their own volition. They stay employed. If they are at risk of losing employment and need a little more help from VR, they can come back and get a light touch to stay employed or find a new trajectory. But this is not a program that's a lifespan program around employment. It's a program that helps launch people into career or helps people who've had career relaunched, like in the case of Myron. In his case, the ticket program that was referenced is a program that looks at individuals who are receiving federal benefits, and it allows them to say, I'd like to work, even though to qualify for those benefits, they had to attest that they could no longer work. And this program is really important because what it says is, we won't cut off your benefits entirely if you can go back to work for periods of time. And those benefits matter not as much for the cash sometimes for these individuals, but for the medical medical help they get for their physical or mental or other disability issue. And so what we do through benefits counseling, which you'll hear a little bit about later, is we help figure out with the individual, and you mentioned in a previous hearing that this is something we wish we could offer to all Oregonians who have these kinds of needs and issues. But for people with disabilities, we have stood up, and it's not for all people, it's just for people who use VR, a program that helps them through the process of going to work and managing their income and their benefits so they maximize their employment opportunity, therefore becoming taxpayers and minimizing the burden on public assistance programs.
Thank you very much. Senator Winters.
Thank you. Just a question, and we're having our side comment. Why can't we do that for all the benefit analysis and work?
Yes.
You said it's for voc rehab. Is there any reason? Give us why we can't do it for others.
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, the reason we don't right now just is really a matter of funding. Right now, the VR program is financed to provide benefits counseling for VR recipients. We do have in a policy package an expansion of that service to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And with even more investment, we could expand the service even further.
Follow-up. Particularly when you're talking about financial literacy and some of those, is there any reason why, and when we talk about TANF and some of those, is that provided in part of that training and benefit package?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, it's a great point. As we are facing the self-sufficiency program presentation Wednesday, I think one of the things we're going to talk about is the fact that we have people in that program now who will be reaching the end of their lifetime limit for the program, and we want to commit a dedicated group of people to helping those individuals be able to transition successfully, particularly those who are at risk of never being able to come back into the TANF program. But I think it's a really important conversation. I know there are other financial asset building services often offered through housing programs that do counsel and work with people. This is just a more formal approach to it, which we call benefits counseling, and it's something that we should look to replicate, I believe.
It couldn't agree more.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a comment. I mean, Trina, I just want to say, Madam Director, I really do appreciate this program that DHS has, because I'm thinking back of another life. In the mid-90s with the Oregon State Police Regional Dispatch Center, we had an opportunity to try a connection with Department of Human Services in this program and Chemeketa Community College. And it was an individual who was disabled and confined to a wheelchair. We had a free employee for essentially 1 year, but we had to provide the training and a job. And that individual turned out to be really a great dispatcher, and we ended up hiring him. That caused us to start looking more and more and having that kind of a relationship with Chemeketa and DHS for programs, that program. And I really felt that it was a great opportunity for us. And so, that's a piece that you didn't describe of the three, but right away, you're saying, I'm just thinking to myself, oh, I just went back in time.
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, thank you for making that point. I do think it's important to note that this program is part of a larger workforce system. It touches the lives of people, young people who are in the education, P through 20 system. It touches the lives of individuals who are in community college. It touches the lives of adults. And if they're able on their own to go take advantage of the workforce system, then that's great, and many do. But if they can't and they're struggling, then that's where the supports of VR, if they have a disability, that's where the supports of this program come to play as a support to help them be successful in some of those other services. They're not duplicative of, but they're supportive, like a wraparound support would be.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thanks, Senator Bates. So the next slide is just the numbers for federal fiscal year 2010 through 2014 of both the adults and the youth that are served, and the youth are the dark blue on the bottom, but you'll notice that the total number served is relatively flat over the last several years, but the number of youth have started to increase.
And co-chairs, if I may, part of the reason for this really is, again, a budget issue. This program, when we get to the budget slides, you'll see this is a block-granted program from the federal government. It has, within the block grant, it also has a matching component. It's one of those interesting and complex funding schemes. The state has managed to spend as much on this program so as to be able to maximize the block granted funding available to us, but has not until this biennium spent more, because once you get above that block granted matching opportunity, the program is 100% general fund. And just as you know, during the recession, those general fund dollars were very precious and hard to come by. So the reason for the stagnation and the level of service is not because there aren't Oregonians who could use the service or who haven't asked, but it's basically a service that is being managed to a particular budget in a very careful way.
Absolutely. And the numbers on this chart, just to know, that are the top three layers of the pyramid, not the Center for Independent Living. There's a separate slide that will talk about the numbers for that. So speaking about some larger numbers, in Oregon, according to the census, there's over 200,000 Oregonians that are working age that experience a disability. And Social Security Administration has issued 165,000 ticket to work for Oregonians, of which 60,000 Oregonians have indicated that they are interested in working. So one of the reasons why I wanted to bring those statistics forth is because as our services are extremely valuable, and I believe we have excellent data to show the outcomes, we have a larger group of individuals in Oregon that potentially could benefit from these services.
There's a couple questions real quick. This slide intrigues me. Okay. What percentage of working age Oregonians actually are disabled right now? Do you know what that number is?
Co-Chair Bates, actually it's the second bullet. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, this is obviously all the way across the United States, 34% of individuals who have disabilities work, and 72% of individuals without disabilities work. So you can just see the differences in that group. Did that answer your question? Not completely.
Senator Bates, we'd have to look at that top number, the over 200,000, yeah, and then compare it to the number of Oregonians that are working age. And I don't have that off the top of my head, but we certainly can come back and tell you what that is.
Looking at it, it's kind of a shock to me that one out of four Oregonians who could be working, according to this slide, aren't working. I mean, 72% of the workforce is working, but the rest aren't. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yes, you are.
I also run the numbers on 18,000, 27,000 a year, real quick up here. 18,000 is $9.50 an hour, and the 27,000 is $14 an hour. So, I understand for the people who have been disabled, many of them work part-time because that's all they can really tolerate, and then they have their benefits, and they don't lose their benefits that way. I assume that's the kind of program you're running, which I think they're excellent. Okay.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, one just slight clarification on the second bullet. So this is of the working age, this is a national statistic, the second bullet, and of those working age individuals with disability, only 32% are working. So that's not of all Oregonians or all people nationally who can work. It's just those with a disability.
I was looking at the second part. I thought 70% of individuals without disabilities are working. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Bates, yes.
I just found this slide intriguing.
So we had 28% that don't work.
We had 28% of the people that don't work. And they don't have disabilities. They just don't work. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Bates, we're using the numbers, yes. And obviously, there could be a lot of variety of reasons for that, and personal lifestyle choices. And
it's tax season. We're thinking about these things. Thank you.
Senator Rogers.
Thank you. While I love the national statistics, what does Oregon look like? I mean, do you have those kinds of numbers for Oregon? I mean, to me, that's where our budget is based on what exists for us. So of the 34% of individuals with disability, what percentage of our disability population is working, and what percentage of non-disability is working in Oregon?
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, and specifically Senator Winters, I do not have the information with me today, but certainly could go back and get the information for you for Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Well, that occurred to me, too. The first bullet is an Oregon statistic. Second is not. but you could extrapolate from if the second is across the board and the average in the country, and take the 34% of those 240, 14, whatever, and that would be the Oregon.
Hopefully not necessarily, Madam Kuchim. Hopefully we're doing better.
I take that back. Excuse me. It said they experience a disability. So figure out what percentage that is of the workforce, I suppose.
Okay, let's continue.
Thank you. The next several slides will be focusing specifically upon the demographics of the individuals within Oregon that are served by vocational rehabilitation, and there's four slides just to give you a sense of the different types of disabilities. These are the top five primary disabilities that have been claimed by our consumers. Recognize, however, that most of the individuals that we serve have more than one disability. This is just their first one, their primary one. And we're going to dive a little deeper into the cognitive impairments. Just a couple of highlights really quickly. The other orthopedic impairments are disability of movement, and so the other physical limitations would be everything other than the disability of movement.
Here's a question, I think. Did you have a question, Senator?
When you come back, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. When you come back on the cognitive impairments and the psychosocial impairments, could you break those down into categories for this and how much of this really falls in, because as we look at mental health issues and what have you on this panel, how many and how much falls into those categories? You know, used to be years and years ago, mental health was not, or those diagnoses was not a part of voc rehab. Today I understand that they are. And so if you could help break down some of those categories for us, I think it would be helpful.
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and Senator Winters, the next slide dives a little deeper in regards to the demographics of the cognitive impairments. That's a 35%, and there's a long laundry list.
That's limited.
On the right-hand side. Does that answer your question, or do you need me to get some additional information?
Well, you've got at the bottom depressed and other mood disorders that are in there down below. See it down there?
Yeah, I did, but...
I guess another way of asking that question, how many, what percentage of your caseload in voc rehab are also the caseload of our caseloads around the mental illness side, which would be over in the Oregon Health Authority side?
Question.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we will get you some specific information about that, but I will say we have really strong partnerships with the Addictions and Mental Health Division. We specifically work with them to provide supported employment services for most of their, for some of their most, their individuals experiencing the most severe and persistent mental illness. I think what we're going to end up coming back to you with is a diagram that shows that sometimes these definitions and categories can differ by program area. In this program area, which is very strongly dominated by the federal definition group, we have that challenge. I think we brought it up when we were presenting on the developmental disability program area as well. So we'll show you a little bit of alignment or where there's misalignment so you can be clear. I think the most important point is one you made, that historically I think people associated this program more with as a program that was helping people that had predominantly physical impairments, and the level of complexity of the consumers that depend on this program has really been increasing. All the way around. And I remember when I first was learning about this program just being really impressed that 60% of the recipients of service are actually experiencing some sort of cognitive or psychological impairment, which requires a very different type of support as people go to work. So we'll get you more detail around the overlap, but just know that there may be a little bit of misalignment due to definitional distinctions.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. Just to reiterate what Senator Winters was saying, I'd love to see the same thing you've done with this exact slide on cognitive impairments. I'd like to see a matching slide for the psychosocial impairments. So just broken down a little bit further in depth, and I think that would help clarify some of the mental health questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson. Representative Stark, we will provide that information.
The next demographic slide talks about the gender and age, and you'll notice that, and this is all these numbers are for the population we serve for fiscal year 14. So we serve 56% male, 44% female, and our top age group was 50 to 59, with our second age group, 20 to 29.
Madam Chair. Have you seen a big jump in the 50 to 59 age group during the recession?
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, the committee, I didn't bring the information of the statistics all the way through, but I certainly can provide that information. We are seeing, however, that the individuals staying in the workforce has increased, I'm assuming for a lot of variety of reasons.
Follow-up. We've seen a national level, at least, an incredible increase in people in that age group who have filed for and received disability, which then comes back down on us. We have this population of the state. And I'll often question whether or not it's more of an economic factor than anything else. There's no jobs. And they can't get retrained at that age very easily. I mean, when you're 58, 59, you can retire in 3 or 4 years of Social Security. It's harder to think about getting retrained and going to something else. And it's a national phenomenon. I just wonder if you've seen it here in Oregon, too. I assume you probably have.
Co-Chair Bates, we also have another interesting situation in the state of Oregon, because about the same time of the Great Recession, we also were in a waiting list for our services. We're currently in what they call the order of selection, but from January of 2009 until late fall of 2010, we were in that waiting list. So it has skewed our numbers a little bit, primarily because we had to serve individuals that came to the top of the waiting list. But with the WIOA changes, a little bit of that is potentially going to change, but I'll talk about that in just a few moments.
Okay.
The last demographic slide talks about race and ethnicity of the individuals that we served within federal fiscal year 2014. And looking at the standard population and the percentage and the demographics of the population, we're relatively close. For example, for whites, we served 81%, but the federal general population is 84%, so we technically served just a few percentages lower. The Hispanic and Latino population, the same. We serve 7%, which is 8.4% in the general population. The other race, ethnicity categories, we, however, did serve over the percentage of the general population. I've been focusing upon the Oregonians that we've served, the WHO, but I would like to then shift the presentation a little bit to what we do, the services that we provide. As many of the committee members have already pointed out, and same with Director Erin Kelly-Seal, we have substantial partnerships with multiple programs within Department of Human Services, with Aging and People with Disabilities, the Office of Developmental Disabilities, AMH, Education, Employment, and the Centers for Independent Living. And you'll notice the little triangle has returned. So talking about all different layers of the triangle, the services that we provide to consumers, employers, and providers. I'm going to do a little bit deeper dive into each one of these. The next slide really shows the process of how you get into the doors and what happens with a person that comes in for our services. An individual coming in for VR services makes application, and we have a responsibility to make a determination of eligibility within a 60-day period of time. And then from once eligibility is determined, we have 90 days to get them to plan. Now, this is a significant change. Prior to the passing of the WIOA, we had 180 days to get individuals into plan. Now, a plan can be is very much based upon individuals and the individual's needs, so they're going to be very different from person to consumer to consumer. So the length of time from plan to closure will definitely be different.
I'm going to ask you to please explain what the law was that passed, what that acronym stands for.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. The WIOA is the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and I have several slides in the latter portion of the presentation that we'll be talking about that.
Coach Nathanson, I saw you whispering about the acronym, wanted to just explain it and also say that it's a relatively recent last year federal law change. The portions relating to services to people with disabilities took effect immediately upon passage, although no federal rules have yet been promulgated. So we'll talk a little bit more about how we're interpreting and applying and doing our best, but this is a law that affects the entirety of the workforce continuum and VR as one piece of that under the Rehab Act.
The next slide gives you an indication of the individuals that we served in 2014, where they were in the process. Please note that this is not a cohort. So, for example, in 2014, we received 7,679 applications. We determined 6,849 individuals eligible. So some of those individuals could have made application in the prior year. And then 4,000 individuals entered into plan, of which we saw 2,649 employments, and we closed cases successfully with rehabilitation 2,376 times. You will notice, however, the difference between the number that were determined eligible and going into plan. And there's a variety of reasons for that. First and foremost, individuals, once they go through this exploratory exercise, may decide that it's just not necessarily the right time to seek employment. Maybe their housing might have some issues, or they need to seek medical attention for a period of time. And the other reason is, believe it or not, is individuals move and they either lose contact with us or move out of state and whatnot. So that's some of the reasons why that number is different. Again, please note that these numbers represent the top three layers of our chart today.
Representative Kenny Gallier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would that account for all of the differences between eligibility and plans, or are there some failures on the part of the department to get people who are eligible to have a plan developed, either because of overload on caseload or something else?
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer, believe it or not, only 1% of the individuals that we serve are too difficult to serve. I mean, we really try to meet them wherever they are. I will need to come back with very specific detailed information as to the percentages, as to why, and the number of cases in the specific categories. I just highlighted the top couple, but there are additional reasons that potentially could happen.
Okay, and follow up? And I would be curious about the next step also from plan to employments, why people who have a plan don't get employment, whether it's a lack of job opportunities out there, or again, a case management load issue, or what?
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, specifically Representative Kenny Geyer, please realize that a plan may take multiple years to see fruition. For example, in the Myron's example, he had come to us in 2009 but didn't have placement until 2014. Mm-hmm. So there could be just a lag depending upon when an individual comes into plan to where they are able to seek employment. At this point, I'm going to shift to the base layer of the pyramid, the Centers for Independent Living, and we will talk a little bit about, when we get to the budget section at the end of this presentation, about the funds that get passed through to the centers, but I do want to highlight some of the services that the centers do. These are consumer-driven model, and you'll notice the map that's here, where they're nonprofit organizations where by their own regulations, 51% of their board and their staff are people with disabilities. But in actuality, it's closer to 65 to 80% of the individuals working with working for the centers and also their board of directors have disabilities. They provide five different core services, which include information and referral, peer counseling, independent living skills training, systems advocacy and self-advocacy support, and transition to community. Some of the centers provide some additional services as well above the five core services, with technical assistance, community education and outreach, social recreational, respite, and adaptive equipment loans. The centers are, they follow the State Plan for Independent Living, the SPIL, of which right now they are just beginning to have meetings to create the next one. Right now the SPIL is from 2014 to 2016. And what else can I tell you about?
Questions?
Senator Bates.
I know some parts of the state don't have a Center for Independent Living. Is there some reason for that? Am I reading the map right or wrong here?
Co-chair Senator Bates.
Like Lynn and Marion, I can't.
Yes, there are 14 counties that are not represented by a Center for Independent Living at this point, at this time. Last biennium, there was an investment that was given to the centers it was multiple phases that they worked on with their plan to address the expansion of the services and the stabilization. That's a very important piece because they needed to make sure that they didn't lose those valuable services. So the stabilization has occurred, and the next phase is reaching out and providing services into the other counties, of which the center directors are currently meeting on that issue to be able to expand.
Hello. Yes. Hello. So people living in those areas don't have these services right now.
Co-Chair Bates, the people within those areas do have some of the five services, specifically around the WIN program and the STEPS program are being offered. And the centers, as I said, are currently trying to figure out what their plan is, either to have pilot projects in those areas to increase the services.
Thank you.
And I'm going to follow up. So someone living in one of the counties on the coast, the northern coast or southern coast, or let's say east of the, Hood, in the Hood River area. So if you're in Hood River, Sherman County, or one of those others, and there are, you said, maybe a few services available,
right.
How is someone receiving services directly from the state? How would that work if there's not an organizing entity?
Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates. So my understanding is that they're not actually receiving a service from the SIL. What they have is the opportunity to connect by phone to some of the resources that may or may not be available. The SILs are very important partners in the Aging and Disability Resource Connection groups, and so they do have access online or by phone to information. And they, of course, through a Voc Rehab office, which are our offices, which are statewide, they can also access Voc Rehab services. But at the moment, I think you're highlighting a really important disparity in those communities, which is that they don't have access to the level of service that communities with a center have.
Thank you.
Moving on to the different performance measures for the Centers for Independent Living, you'll notice that the numbers of individuals served have continued to increase through, and again, this is for the base layer of the pyramid. And the consumer goes over to the right. This tells actually only part of the story. The SILs, they track multiple things, not only the number of goals that consumers choose, but they also track the progress and successful goals, but unfortunately not represented on this slide. And the consumer goals, to be honest with you, the data information ebbs and flows because it depends upon the individual. They may choose more than one goal. They may not choose a goal for a period of time when they're first establishing contact with the centers. The percentage of satisfied customer, there's another clarification I need to provide. In between 2011 and 2012, the mechanism, the method for surveying the customers changed. So the first 3 years of the slide cannot necessarily be translated into the second 3 years. So please see that there should be a little line that's drawn indicating that there's a difference.
Coaches, I would add, though, that I do think that you see the impact of the investment that you made as to shore up the infrastructure for the centers in that 2014 period. I think the centers have had more capacity in that last year than they've had prior to, and as Trina mentioned, they are working on how to continue to build out their capacity. These are, as also was mentioned, very consumer-driven, self-determined entities, and so they depend heavily on local engagement and enthusiasm for the work, and I think have been building a wider and wider network as they go.
That's correct. Moving on up the pyramid to the basic services. The basic services, please remember that these are very individualized and based upon the consumer's needs, and assist individuals with disabilities to find and enter and maintain employment.
This service provides very intensive counseling and intervention and support services, and occasionally, if needed, assistive technology. And so in federal fiscal year 2014, we served 12,000 Oregonians within our basic services. Moving up the pyramid to the Youth Transition Program, we served 3,400 youth in Oregon last year. Now the youth ages are from ages 16 to 21, and they were, for the Youth Transition Program, they must be in school when they start the program. And one of the things that this slide points out is that this is a new pattern of service within schools and communities, because we are engaging in schools sooner than we have in the past. Currently, there's transition specialists in 105 school districts, which means 120 high schools, so about two-thirds of the state are covered right now in our pilot programs for YTP. Our numbers for the youth transition program, you're going to see a slide later in the deck, are a little bit less than this, because the youth numbers also include the youth that fall within the IDD population as well, that may not necessarily be within the youth transition program high schools.
I'm going to ask a very detailed question. You may not know the answer. I'm trying to imagine the connection between human services and education, as far as budget goes and organizationally and the departments. And for this one, you mentioned the number of school districts that have someone available. Is that through individual school districts, or are there places where there are education service districts that might employ someone to specialize in this area to serve multiple school districts through an ESD? Do you happen to know?
Co-Chair Nathanson, I do not have that information at this point.
Co-Chair Nathanson, I'm going to get back to you with more detail, but we do have very detailed MOUs. My experience with those is they are predominantly at the school district level. They involve a willing partner, you know, at the superintendent level to allow for us to come into the school program and offer this particular service widely to youth with disabilities. We also, separate and apart from that, have VR counselors that actively participate with young people in their individual education planning sessions so that they can be successful as they progress from school. So one is a broader touch, just really creating a conversation about work ethic and post-school educational opportunity, work opportunity for youth with disabilities. The other is more targeted to an individual level, and this program does both.
Okay. I would appreciate some follow-up information on where the agreements are and how the services are provided. There are a number of very large school districts, well, a handful of very large school districts. There are some medium-sized school districts, and then there are lots with a very much smaller student population. Those are the ones where it might be more important to provide service, but it's on a relatively small scale. And I'm hoping that we are engaging with ESDs, who are, in a way, a more efficient way of reaching out to those kinds of school districts.
Representative Nathanson, we'll get that information to you. The only other thing I would add is this is also a pretty significant effort with the Department of Education. We also have agreements with them, and they've asked us to consider how we would go about expanding the program statewide. The policy package that comes later starts to move more in that direction. Right now, it started out as a voluntary program. It's won several awards, which I think you're going to get to, and it's something we're looking to expand upon.
Thank you.
Moving on up to the top part of the pyramid is the supported employment, and specifically vocational rehabilitation served, 254 individuals under supported employment. These are very intensive services and targeted mostly for the populations in the IDD program, a traumatic brain injury, and severe and persistent mental illness. Some of the examples of the services provided by supported employment would be extra job coaching, on-the-job training, and assisting with coping with more than just issues on the job. So it's very much side-by-side, hands-on.
Oops.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
I'm just getting a little confused about this sometimes. Supported employment is different than the people who are in sheltered employment. Is that correct?
Co-chairs.
We've had a lot of discussions about this group.
Senator Bates, that's correct.
And so supported employment, you only have about 250 people in that.
Senator Bates. Correct. Yeah. That required that very intensive. Right. Now, there's a slide further in the presentation that talk about the number of individuals that have rehabilitated that have some sort of supports, and this number is included in that, but it could be a little bit lighter touch as well, depending upon the needs of the individual, that they needed to have that support even after we closed the case.
And Co-Chair Bates, I also just want to distinguish that those are individuals who have access to VR service and then qualified for that additional support. We have other individuals in addition to that cohort, particularly who are receiving developmental disability services, who are getting support for their employment placement through the ODDS Medicaid program. So they don't duplicate, but they do work together to ensure the number, and we can get it for you of how much is duplicative or not in terms of the overlap and the total number, but there is a higher number of people who are being supported through integrated employment services to get to work than you see just through the VR program.
I would like to see that how many persons are receiving supported employment, regardless of which individual fund the money comes from or which work group or department or section of an agency is delivering the service. I know sometimes that's hard to go across departments, but I would like to see the scope of that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did the sheltered workshop people show up at all in this triangle?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, I would answer that I don't believe that they do. I think that they may show up in terms of when you look back at the continuum of service in the area of individuals who are coming into the program on application and then qualifying for work. They would not show up as an employment placement. My understanding of the Rehab Act is that VR is not able to count an employment placement in a sheltered work setting.
That is correct.
Shifting over slightly to the services for providers, I wanted to make sure that the committee recognized that we do support providers as well with several different examples. The slide will show trainings, webinars, our in-service and benefit and work incentive training. We also provide diversity and inclusion consultation and support as well. The same is true for the services for employers. I have a few examples on the slide that talk about the different activities that we have done for employers. It might be through contracts with the employers. But what's interesting is that we have found that it's really important that we support our providers and our employers to be able to help deal with the stigma. And Representative Olson gave a really great example earlier today around working with individuals with disabilities.
Senator.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Could you talk a little bit about how you find employers to work with and whether that's difficult and what you found to be successful in recruiting employers?
Co-Chair Nathanson and Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, we have several individuals on our staff that work directly with larger employers to be able to open those doors, but also depending upon the different areas across the state, our vocational rehabilitation counselors also establish relationships with local employers. Some of the examples I used in the beginning of the presentation talked a little bit about some of the as an example of reaching out to the different employer communities. Additionally, there on the right-hand side of the slide, you'll see the Think Beyond the Label, which is an interesting website that you can go to and assist employers with obtaining different incentives and whatnot for hiring individuals with disabilities.
Co-chair Senator Steiner Hayward, I just want to add too that VR has contracts with job developers that are performance-based, and job developers individually go into small, medium, large employers and do what's called job carving or job placement activity for individuals. So there's sort of a sandwich approach. There's a larger effort just in general to help employers be better employers of people with disabilities. We are used as a resource in that respect quite a bit. The federal contractors at this point in time have a requirement that 7% of their employees have disabilities, and so we've been heavily utilized by federal contracting agencies to help support them to be able to meet that federal target. And then also on an individual basis, when we meet an individual, we work with that person, and our contractors work to go out into communities small and large and help create jobs. And sometimes that's not necessarily an employer we've had a previous relationship with, but it's someone that we've gone out and specifically targeted a relationship with. The last thing I would say is that VR is a partner locally in the local workforce investment boards, and as you know, those boards are right now working on sector strategies and working to identify employers that are doing on-the-job training and other workforce activities, and we're often able through that, through leveraging of those partnerships at the local level, to create work opportunity through employers that are known to those local boards.
Thank you.
Pivoting a little bit in regards to a few other items that we have in things that we have accomplished for vocational rehabilitation, notwithstanding the providing the services that I talked about in the previous slides, but we have focused upon performance-based job development contracts and by requiring training, establishing minimum qualifications. We've been shifting from a fee for service to benchmark payments. Increasing also our performance auditing, and we've seen a reduction in the cost per outcome. It says case there, but it should be outcome based upon performance-based contracting. Additionally, here are our employment outcomes. You'll notice on the top left-hand side the employment outcomes for the different fiscal years. Over to the right, the supported employment outcomes. The youth transition, and one of the numbers fell off, so my apologies, it should be 303, so it's a little bit less in 13 than it was in 12. We have recovered from that for the youth transition program to serve 552 individuals within that program specifically, and our rehab rate continues to increase to 62%. So moving on as to what's next. Multiple days ago, last week, there was a presentation to this committee around Employment First, and Employment First is a very key pivot for vocational rehabilitation, as we'll be working more and more with individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Also, the Workforce Innovation, this is investment here, but it's supposed to be Innovation and Opportunity Act, WIOA, changes. All the way through, we really emphasize the need to leverage and align our partnerships all across, not only within the programs of DHS, but out external as well. And then we'll have to, we need to continue to improve our efficiency and our financial stability or sustainability. Because the, as Aaron had, Director Kelly Seal had indicated earlier around WIOA, we do not have the regulations out. We thought that they would be out in January, but unfortunately that hasn't happened. We're expecting them to be sometime in the spring to have the proposed rules. But we're going to need to have continued conversations with this group as to what that looks like and how we implement in the state of Oregon.
And, Coachers, I would just add to that, and I think in the next couple slides we'll also touch on it. I think that we're at an important point with this program where we need to really focus again on the budget. A few years ago, we did what was a five-year plan for voc rehab so that we could meet the maintenance of effort requirements, maximize the federal funding opportunities, and also, make sure that we were achieving as much as we could with the general fund that was available. We're sort of nearing the end of that fiscal plan, and I think it's a good time to revisit it, particularly given the new demands that are there for the program around that Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. We know that, for example, we now have new requirements around a percentage of investment that must be made in youth. We've been talking a lot about the youth transition program. It's not a bad thing to do, and I know that the workforce committees, workforce and education committees, are also talking about more investment in youth employment given the rates of unemployment among youth right now. So there are new requirements in the law, both in terms of spending requirements, but also in terms of requirements for the counselors. And you heard about one already. Previously, the rule said that you could take 180 days to work with an individual, learn about their talents, their skills, their goals, work with them on what a plan could look like to achieve those. That time has now been reduced to 90 days. We're actively monitoring our data to know how often we're meeting those deadlines, but those are new deadlines in the federal law itself that are creating new requirements, new pressures on our counselors at the very time when the demand for service is also going up. So I think that as we think about the future funding for this program and some of the investment opportunities and how and whether we want to consider the issue of an order of selection, because if we're not able to reach demand and we're not able to serve all of those people that are coming in the door, there is this requirement that we go into an order. And the order does then shift for the state mandatorily the population that gets served. The federal law requires that those with the most significant disabilities be prioritized for service, which means that people with perhaps a less significant disability but who may need a lighter touch to go straight to work cannot be served by the voc rehab program when we're in an order, because we're serving only those that within the budget box meet those federal criteria. So those are some of the dilemmas that are coming up. And because we're in this place of transition with this federal law and its regulations, we're deeply sorry that we can't come to you with more concreteness, but we really hope that by the time you're passing our budget that we're going to be able to have had those conversations with you so we all can go in fully aware of what the next 2 years will bring for this program in terms of our ability to serve people.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erin, you said something that really struck me, and it's the part about we have been used to having 180 days and it's now down to 90. And it just occurs to me several wonderings. How is this driven? Why did this sort of thing start crunching that time period? Is this somebody's staff person's assistant who's thinking, I'll make sure that I remain relevant and I'll throw forward all these time-saving efficiency moves, et cetera? Do you think, and this is kind of one of those, that they consider that these regulations and these requirements and deadlines affect real people in real ways, or how they affect them? And do you have any ability to, I know I'm asking a lot, any ability to say, hey, no, wait a minute, it's been working well this way, we don't treat everybody the same, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just baffled by this.
Co-Chairs, Representative Boone, I appreciate the questions. It's been a while since what used to be the workforce, now I'm not going to remember the old acronym, but the old Workforce Act had been reauthorized. And I know year after year, it really was the hope that it would actually be made more relevant to the time. And I know that disability advocate groups were very active in making sure that their voices were heard as part of that conversation. I do think it's harder when you get further and further away from the front line and the people that are impacted to really appreciate what that impact means. I think what we feel as a state receiving this direction in this federal program is that we would have liked to have had more time to implement it. I think it was a surprise to all of us when we got through the 700-page piece of legislation to learn that the regulations relating to this program took effect on impact. And unfortunately, there was a lot of confusion because the actual final version of the bill wasn't even available to the programs for several months until after the bill had passed and we were all working on getting final copies. It wasn't the best process, shall we say, in terms of what actually ended up passing and then the communication out to programs. It's always a good reminder to us as, I think, state program deliverers to remember how it feels for our local teams then when we do things like this, when we change rules really abruptly, when we don't give people time to implement. We sometimes are on the receiving end of that, and sometimes we're on the end that puts that out there. And so it's always good, I think, and humbling to be where we are. I guess I would say that I think that the VR counselors have done incredible work already. When we dug deeper into the data, we didn't immediately panic around the change in the time frame, because we did have a significant number of our consumers who were already getting to the plan within the 90-day time limit, and so it allowed us to target our work to continue the efficiency to get that group that wasn't quite meeting it there. I think if we do get to a point where we're realizing addressing that people are being harmed, that they're not getting a service they might have gotten previously, we'll want to come back to you and maybe engage the federal delegation differently. I don't think we're quite there yet. We haven't, I don't think, fully realized yet the impact of this until we get a little further in our implementation of it. We just did a series of statewide trainings in the late fall to make sure that counselors know what the rules are. We have our lean leader looking at opportunities to streamline the business process, so we're eliminating any waste and making sure the value add of our process with the consumer is all there. When we get, though, through that, and if we see then what is the percentage and who are the people that we're not able to get to 180 days, if we realize then that we're significantly disadvantaging certain groups as opposed to it just being, you know, our issue that we need to work on, then we will come back and talk with you about that. It's just really too soon, I think, in implementation to tell.
Just a quick follow-up, too. We're hearing from other areas of your sector, too, the need for additional funds to hire people or pay overtime or something like that just to get... And is that just in reaction to these crunch times that are being implemented on you and so that you can meet these federal deadlines without impunity? And so it seems to me that that's sort of an act of reacting instead of just being able to thoughtfully implement these programs to help these people in them.
Co-chairs, Representative Boone, I do think there are a series of things happening all at once in the community that serves people with disabilities. I think everybody has the same goal in mind, that work is great and that many people in this community want to work, and we want to be able to help them to do that thoughtfully and planfully. I do think that a lot of the administrative changes and rule changes that have taken place in the last 2 years are putting a lot of pressure on those of us who are delivering the service and also a lot of our partners. And we certainly have been paying really close attention to the capacity issues. It's why in that Employment First arena, we talked to you a little bit about needing to be able to be sure that we're not moving so quickly that we leave people behind, that we lose business capacity when in fact we want to be rebuilding it or supporting it to transform as opposed to just go away. No one's interested in losing capacity. In fact, we need more of it, and we're trying to, you know, make recommendations to you about the best way as a state that we can support that to happen under these different time constraints that we're working within.
There's something that you mentioned earlier in this most recent set of comments you've been making about priority of who should be served. And looking ahead to the next slide, I noticed that there is an item on here that says changes to order of selection. Who is priority? Is that what you were referring to, Ms. Kelly Seal?
Co-Chair Nathanson, actually, I can speak to this. The changes in the order of selection, as I indicated earlier, was based upon the number of significant disabilities and barriers as a person has entering the workforce. The change that we allows us to do is to take a look at if a person is currently working and at risk of losing that employment, then we can potentially move them up higher into the priority to be able to stabilize that situation so they're not losing that employment. That's the changes that is referred to in this slide.
Thank you. Otherwise, the order of selection, would you please restate what you said? I think I heard that those with the greatest barriers must be served more or first. How can you explain a little bit more what will be required? Because I'm also anticipating that if the emphasis is there, does it mean you spend up to 100% of resources working with those persons who might even be least likely to find a satisfactory employment situation quickly?
Co-Chair Nathanson, that is true. So the prioritization, and I'm having a little bit of deja vu. I think if you look at the record from this subcommittee a couple of years ago when we were testifying, we had a very similar conversation about just the challenge that this policy dilemma would present to the state. It would require us, other than the exception that is new around people at risk of losing employment, it would require the VR program, the VR counselors, to prioritize their services to those who experience the most barriers to work. And there's a very specific way we can get you more information about what that looks like and what the priority levels are. And we have had experience with it as a state. And what then happens is that people that are on that lower priority priority level go on to a waiting list for service. And the energy is dedicated to those with the most barriers getting to work. That's the federal policy. It's what they direct all VR programs in the country to do.
For those, I'm thinking back to a slide, many slides ago, with how many people are in the application process, how many are getting counseling, how many end up with the job. Understanding that it's not a cohort, it's just for a period of time. But still, there are some persons who will never, perhaps never successfully get a job, or not within the first 5 years, let's say. So the federal government is advising us we must spend the most time on perhaps the persons who are least likely to get jobs, while others languish, and but for a little bit of help might have been employed then? Is that what they're telling us?
You're talking about prioritizing,
yeah.
What was mentioned earlier. I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I heard.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that's correct. My understanding of the rationale for the policy is really one of equity, that those who require a lighter touch are also more likely to be able to self-initiate and work through the workforce system on their own. And so this program is really targeting those who have the least chance of being able to take advantage of those other services that are in the community. And I completely appreciate, I mean, again, as I'm saying, I can remember having this conversation with Speaker Kotek in the committee, and I think that it's one that we hope, I mean, I just want to put on the record that we would hope not to get to, that we would hope to be able to work with you around what this program's budget would be so that we avoid that and we can then have, you know, not go into an order, not have a waiting list. But I think when you look at the cost per outcome, what you could expect under an order is that the cost per outcome would go up significantly, because the level of effort required for some of those more significant individuals alone is going to be more than some of the other outcomes that we're able to achieve for people who need a little bit less support to achieve their goals.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelly Seale, correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember 2 years ago sitting here with you all talking about how you had to prioritize TANF recipients who were looking for assistance and categorizing them in sort of four categories about work readiness, right? And in those cases, you were talking about prioritizing people who were more likely to be able to get back to work. Am I remembering correctly?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, we do have three categories in the TANF program, which we'll talk about on Wednesday.
Actually relevant.
We actually ended up during the recession focusing on the middle group, the most ready to work with the fewer barriers. We made referrals to the workforce system and have been working on increasing partnerships with the workforce system to try and share data so that we could track what happened to those individuals. Those with the most barriers, we did not serve during the recession at all, really. And of that middle cohort that had that fell into that middle of the continuum, if you will, we only, with the TANF budget at that time, served about 15%, just because of the level of reduction. But we made a little bit different policy choice for the basic reason that we felt like those that were least barriered probably could go to the workforce centers with a little bit of referral, warm handoff, and some support.
Right.
But the folks with the most significant barriers at the time, the committee, for the policy direction was employment would be less likely for those individuals. We want to make sure they don't crash off the safety net program. They still had supports from the program, but that they weren't receiving employment advancement services, basically.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Yeah, just real quickly, I think what you're looking at is a policy decision here at the federal level of helping those that didn't need the greatest help first and others not. In my personal life, professional life, I deal with a lot of people with disabilities as far as getting to work is concerned. And the breadth of this is amazing. I mean, you've got people who just have a little bit of a problem, and they often can find work on their own. It may take a little longer, but they can find something. And others have severe disabilities, need a lot of support, a lot of effort, really have to work for an employer and get things done. And I think the decision has been, since we can't take care of everybody all the time like we'd like to, where's the greatest need? And I think the federal government said the greatest need, since this is mainly federal money, is these people who have the greatest need as far as a chance getting back to work. So I think that's what you're trying to tell us. That's what I've seen in my personal and public life. And I think it's actually a pretty good decision. A better decision would be we're going to give you $200 million and treat everybody or care for everybody. But that's not going to happen. So you're taking the resources you have and you're focusing on, because the feds have said you're going to do this, on people with the greatest disability. And they're the ones that need the most help to try to get into the workforce. That's what I think I'm hearing. Would you agree with that?
Coach Bates, absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head that we need to be targeted and really intentional with our services as much as possible. A few other highlights on this slide really quickly before we pivot into the budget. The changes to the performance metrics, I just want to bring to this committee that, and as I've been speaking the last hour or so, we've always counted the number of employments, the number of rehabilitations, but that's going to change a little bit under WIOA, where we have to take a look at sustainability of that employment. So there will be a look at the second and the fourth quarter after the employment to see how effective the services were. So as we take a look at that, we are anticipating, and it's a different look, a different lens for us, and it would be really interesting to see what those numbers look like.
And coaches, I would just say this is lining up with finding work, keeping work, and also tracking the wages earned. Right. And so we've been working with the workforce system partners around those three basic metrics so that all of the workforce programs, including Voc Rehab, the jobs program, and the workforce programs are looking at the same things, just for different population groups.
Additionally, the services to employers, WIOA is requiring us to step up the game, so to speak, where we're really creating relationships with the employers to be able to have successful placements. I'm going to pivot over to Eric Moore, the Chief Financial Officer. I keep trying to give you different jobs today, Eric, to talk about the budget.
Co-Chairs Bates-Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Moore, the Chief Financial Officer for Department of Human Services. You've become familiar with these slides. The first slide is really showing the staff providing direct services at 46% up in the program delivery section, that we provide direct policy supports to program is at about 4.5% of the budget. The State Independent Living Council is about 2.4% of the budget. That budget is primarily passed through to our Centers on Independent Living. We can't use, and I'll get to the Mow and Match in a moment, but we can't use those dollars for Mow and Match. And then 47.1% of the budget passes out to providers and vendors directly out into the community. The next slide is effectively the same slide that you just saw, only with the State Independent Living Council wrapped into the direct payment portion of the budget. So you can see that the numbers and the percentages are just a little bit different on this slide. On the last slide, by fund type, we get a very favorable match for the basic $110. It's about a 4-to-1 match, so it's a good match, but it's a block grant. And with that block grant comes a maintenance of effort, or MOE, that we have to keep up in order to gain those federal dollars. So we both have a matching component and a maintenance of effort component in that budget. The interesting thing about the maintenance of effort here in this particular grant is that the more you spend, the more you have to continue to spend. So as that general fund investment increases, it resets the maintenance of effort bar for the program. The other funds are local match, generally for the youth transition program from the school districts, used to draw down basic 110 funding for the schools. And the federal funds, again, primarily the 76.3% of the budget is primarily basic 110 funding, which is the primary fund source for the program.
So in summary, a few parting thoughts as I leave you today, just reminding about our mission, why we're here to serve individuals with disabilities to achieve and maintain employment, And that vocational rehabilitation is a part of the state's workforce system that meets the needs of an extremely complex population. That our services build upon and extend upon the work of other state programs, both in and out of DHS, that we are definitely leveraging resources, and that we're creating innovative programs that can serve as models for other programs. So hopefully, we hit upon the major themes, the budget themes for the Department of Human Services, and I know that coming up later this week, there will be, obviously, we have the public testimony that already happened last week, the Commission for the Blind, Self-Sufficiency Program, and Child Welfare.
Do you have anything else?
Did you have a question, Senator Gates?
Hey, she's got them.
Okay.
I gave them to her. Well, I'll take the time to welcome you.
I do appreciate the opportunity today, and thank you so very much.
Thank you all for your comments. With all the great information, the responses to our questions. Anything else from the committee? We're adjourned. Adjourned.